Chapter 85, England, the Anglican State Church. Through sin the earth has been cursed. Through sin every person is bowed down beneath cares and sorrows, because these are the terrible consequences of our departure from God. Every person has a warfare upon earth. Man does not realize that he himself is the cause of all the sorrow that is being suffered in this world. No, we are so inclined to cast the blame upon others. Yea, worse, secretly we blame God. Even though we dare not declare it outright, yet those thoughts dwell within our hearts. How often we stand with clenched fists raised upward. That enmity toward God and our neighbor is rooted within every heart, and yet we must blame ourselves for all those vexations which befall us in this life. That does not only concern the poor, but also the rich. It makes no difference whether we are a beggar or a powerful monarch. Grief and sorrow is in the palaces of kings, as well as in the cottage of the poor. No one is exempt from that. King Henry VIII, who ruled over England from 1509 to 1547, also experienced that. See him sitting upon his costly throne in one of the many halls of his palace. Gloomily, he stares straight ahead. A peevish, dissatisfied feature lies upon his countenance. At times he shakes his head sadly. Then again he clenches his fists and his lips draw together to a narrow line. Being vexed, he arises and with angry steps walks back and forth, back and forth. "And yet it has to happen," he mumbles threateningly. Henry VIII, the powerful king of England, cannot get his way, and now he is angry. What does he really want? Yea, that is quite a story. The original plan of his parents was that Henry VIII would be trained for the clergy. He must become Archbishop of Canterbury. This city is situated in the southeast of England, between London and Dover. His older brother Arthur was crown prince, and he would become king in the place of his father. But what happened? Arthur dies, and now Henry VIII became king of England. Nothing became of the nice plan that he would become Archbishop of Canterbury. Henry shall not wear the attire of the clergy, but the crown. Although Arthur had died while young, yet he was already married. His wife's name was Catherine of Aragon. She was a daughter of the King and Queen of Spain. She was very wealthy. A life of luxury and abundance lay before her. Rich and honored, could it be any better? How different did it terminate? Arthur, her husband, died. She was still very young and then a widow already. What a disappointment! Yet she did not remain unmarried for long, because a short time later she married her brother-in-law, Henry VIII. Those marriages were forbidden in the Old Testament. Just read Leviticus 20, verse 21. The punishment which was threatened upon that was to be childless. Yet this marriage took place. The Pope gave his consent to that. This marriage was contracted with great pomp and splendor, and Catherine was the honored woman again. Yet she had much sorrow in her life. two sons died immediately after they were born. Of the three daughters which she had, only one remained alive. Her husband, Henry VIII, was a strict Roman Catholic. As we told you before, the seed of the Reformation had been sown in England by John Wycliffe. You still remember that name, do you not? His followers, who were called Lollards, were persecuted with much blood. Henry VIII was also a bitter enemy of them. When the writings of Martin Luther were being spread and eagerly read in England, the king wrote a book against Luther in which he defended the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope commended the English king and called him Defender of the Faith. The years went swiftly by. Henry VIII always had hopes that he would have a son, but that fervent wish was not realized. Naturally, many nobles and maids of honor were connected with the court of the king. The name of one of those maids of honor was Anne Boleyn. Finally, Henry VIII wanted to separate from his wife Catherine and conclude a new marriage with Anne Boleyn. Again, he asked permission from the Pope. Although it was forbidden in the scripture, the Pope had first approved of his first marriage, and now he must declare that same marriage illegal. It is true, in the meantime, the former Pope had died, and in Rome another Pope had become the head of the Roman Catholic Church. This new Pope at first intended to give Henry VIII his way. But when he noticed that Charles V, the Emperor of Germany, did not approve of that, he would not give his consent for fear of Charles V. Perhaps you shall think, what did Charles V have to do with that? But you must know that Catherine of Aragon was an aunt of Charles V. He considered that an insult to his aunt, and in that he was right. For that reason, Henry VIII is angry and dissatisfied. He wants to separate from his wife, and he cannot get his way, because the Pope refuses to give his consent to that. However, the English king has no intention to resign himself to that. That is out of the question. He shall have his way. If then the Pope refuses to approve of his plans, then he shall do it without the consent of the Pope. Just as in all other countries, a papal nuncio was also in England, a certain Thomas Wolsey. This nuncio was dismissed by the English king, and a new Archbishop of Canterbury was appointed in the place of Thomas Wolsey. That new cleric's name was Thomas Cranmer. Remember that name, because we shall hear more of him. Cranmer immediately chose the side of the king and supported him in his plans. He said, "King, you must not listen to that which the Pope tells you, but you must act according to what is written in God's word. In God's word, the marriage with the wife of your brother is forbidden." "Well, then, it is forbidden. Then you may not have her as your wife." We know that this pertained to the time of the Old Testament, although such marriages are usually not to be recommended. Therefore, as Archbishop of Canterbury, Cranmer pronounced the separation between Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. He also confirmed the marriage between the English king and his maid of honor, Anne Boleyn. It is soon known what has taken place at the English court. It is self-evident that it also reached the ears of the Pope, that Henry VIII had nevertheless forced his way through. He is very much displeased with that, and he puts the English monarch under the ban. The king does not care one bit about that papal excommunication. As a countermeasure, he separates the English church from Rome. He says to the Roman Catholic clergy in England, "You no longer need to nor have to obey the Pope. From now on, I am the head of the English church. The Pope has nothing to say here anymore." The church taxes, which were often very heavy, were no longer paid. The English monasteries were closed. Most of those monasteries were rich and possessed extensive landed estates. Well then, all those ecclesiastical monasterial possessions were confiscated. They reverted to the state, to the crown. From now on, the king would have the disposal of them, and he did what he pleased with them. Part of that money and those estates he used for himself. Since he needed much money for his luxurious court life and many feasts, he could make good use of that. Another part he gave to the nobility. He hoped that out of gratitude the English nobles would support him. In that way he tried to buy the favor and friendship of the English nobles. Now there were still numerous Roman Catholics in England who did not agree with the decrees of the king. They did not acknowledge Henry VIII as the head of the English church, and they opposed the new regulations. These people were persecuted by the king and put to death. However, Thomas Cranmer, the new archbishop, did agree with the king. He was reformation-minded, and just for that reason, he was very happy that the power of the Pope in England was broken. That agreed exactly with his plans. In those tumultuous days, England also obtained its own Bible. An English linguist, a certain Tyndale, translated the Bible into the English native tongue. Those English Bibles were spread by the thousands and read. Through that, more and more Protestants came in England. The writings of Luther also constantly obtained more publicity among the English people. They were likewise translated into English and were eagerly read. Thus the way was paved also for the Reformation in England. But neither was that the intention of the English monarch. It is true, the clergy need no longer obey the Pope of Rome. He was the English Pope. He would decree how the church had to be ruled. But the doctrine of the church must remain the same. He would have nothing to do with the Reformation. Yea, he stood hostile over against that. Thus it happened that the Protestants who did not agree with that were also persecuted. It happened more than once that Roman Catholics and Protestants were hung on the gallows next to each other. The new English church also received a name. From now on, it would be the Anglican Church. That was fully a state church. Indeed, the king decided in all important matters which concerned the church. The state ruled over the church. We know for a long time already that this is wrong. In the meantime, Henry VIII lived his sinful life. He was married only 5 years to Anne Boleyn. A daughter was born out of this marriage, the future Queen Elizabeth. We shall hear more about her. The King of England had Anne Boleyn beheaded upon the scaffold, and he himself married again with another maid of honor. Anne Boleyn was falsely accused. Most likely the king knew very well that this accusation was false, but he wanted to get rid of his second wife so that he could marry the other maid of honor. For that reason, upon that false accusation, Anne Boleyn was condemned to death. How wicked, isn't that so? That was actually a murder. Thus it went on continually. Altogether, Henry VIII has been married 6 times. Thus he had 6 wives. Don't you see that he was a wicked monarch, a murderer of his own wives? Much more could be told about that, but then it becomes too extensive. Neither shall we mention the names of those other wives, because we will not benefit by that. It is true he did loosen the English church from Rome, but he did not do this because he loved the truth, but because he could not get his way. On the contrary, he was and remained an enemy of the Protestants. Those English Protestants were called Puritans. Well then, those Puritans were persecuted by him with much blood until his death. God alone knows how many were put to death by him. This wicked monarch died in 1547. Of him it may be said that he feared not God, neither regarded man. When death came, it was done with his sinful conduct. Then he had to render an account before the Most High. How terrible to have to appear before God in such a condition, because his hands were stained with blood. That blood called for vengeance. Henry VIII had only one son. He was only a little boy of 9 years old when his father died. Yet he became king in the place of Henry VIII. Naturally, that youthful Edward VI, for that was his name, could not rule as yet. An uncle of his became regent for the time being. That means he ruled meanwhile for him. During those years, the Reformation in England was carried through fast because the youthful monarch supported the Reformation as much as he could. You must know that Edward VI had a Protestant mother. Many things changed. The Roman Catholic Mass was abolished. The images and relics were removed from the churches. The persecution ceased. The Church of the Lord was permitted to breathe for a while. That means it obtained rest for a while. Communion was celebrated in a Lutheran manner. We still know that Luther taught the consubstantiation, isn't that so? The Lord Jesus was supposed to be bodily present in and with the bread and wine. Well then, the Protestants in England believed that too. Pitiful. Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, about whom we told you already in the first part of this chapter, compiled a common prayer book in which various prayers were printed which would be used in the church and in the home. An English confession of faith also appeared, which was divided in 42 articles. At that time, many refugees came to England from the mainland of Europe, where the persecution raged, because in England they were not persecuted. The writings of Calvin, who in those days was active in Geneva, were also translated into the English language and distributed by the thousands. Personally, Calvin wrote various letters to the youthful Edward VI, in which he counseled him in difficult matters. Calvin also wrote letters to highly placed persons in the government. By so doing, the great reformer constantly obtained more influence in England. Things went very well. Everything proceeded very prosperously. It seemed as if God's church in England was heading for a flourishing time. And then, how often are God's ways incomprehensible? Then suddenly, Edward VI, who promised so much, died in 1553. We would say, why did the Lord not grant a long life to that king? How much he could have done for the church of the Lord. What a rich blessing he might have been. But God's ways were different. Why did this happen? We cannot answer that. One day the holy design the Lord had with that shall come to light. Great sorrow prevailed among the English Puritans when the tidings of the king's death reached them. However, the Roman Catholics rejoiced, and for that they also had reasons, because in October 1555, two stakes are erected in Oxford, the same city where at one time John Wycliffe was professor at the university which was established there. A great multitude jostle each other upon the extensive marketplace. However, they are kept at a proper distance by a detachment of soldiers who keep an opening around the stakes. Soon two men draw near, being conducted by policemen. The crowded multitude makes room. They are two preachers who shall be put to death. One of them is a gray-haired man of 85 years old. His name is Latimer. The other is much younger, and his name is Ridley. The death sentence has been pronounced upon them, and now it shall be executed. For that reason, those stakes are erected. Both preachers had a restful night, yet this was the last night of their life. We would expect that they were fearful, isn't that so? But that was not so. One of Ridley's friends had offered to remain with him the last night, but Ridley had answered joyfully, "My breakfast may be sharp, but I am sure my supper will be most sweet." Say, what strange words are these? Do you know what he meant with those words? Breakfast is partaken of in the morning, isn't that so? Well, that breakfast would be sharp, because the next morning he would be burned to death. But his supper would be most sweet, because before the nightfall of the next day, he would be in heavenly glory. Behold, that was the meaning of those unusual words. He firmly believed and was sure that after his death he would enter into heavenly glory. And now it has come to that time. Both preachers walk calmly to the stake. Both kneel down and pray God for strength to endure in the hour of trial. After prayer, Ridley embraces the aged Latimer once more and calls to him, "Keep courage, brother. God shall strengthen us." Soon both stand upon the stake. The executioner casts the fire into the wood, and soon the flames coil upward. Soon after that, the aged Latimer has been taken up into eternal glory. His body was consumed to ashes, but his soul ascended up to God. However, the fire of Ridley's stake would not burn through. The wood only kept smoldering. What a torture that was for the brave preacher. Finally, he asks the executioners if they would stir up the wood. This was done, and it wasn't long, or that faithful servant of the Lord also entered into eternal glory. Thus the torture fires burned daily in England. The persecution had again burst loose in all its severity, and Satan grinned. Edward VI was succeeded by his sister Mary. She was a daughter of Henry VIII, and his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. That girl has passed through much in her youth. She has seen and experienced how her mother was disowned by her father. Many times she was in peril of death. A bitter hatred against the Protestants existed within her heart. She was a zealous Roman Catholic, and when in 1553 she became Queen of England, she immediately abolished the Anglican Church and restored the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope was fully acknowledged again as the head of the English Church. The Puritans were persecuted to the blood. Hundreds of them lost their lives at the stake. For that reason, she received a terrible nickname. In history, she is known as Bloody Mary. But not only the Puritans, but also the adherents of the Anglican Church were vehemently persecuted by her. In this trying time, many hundreds who had first sought and found a safe asylum in England fled back again to the mainland of Europe. They crossed the turbulent North Sea in all sorts of small vessels. One time, 175 refugees left England together in two small ships. Many of them fled to the German city of Emden, where they were cordially received and cared for. Really, the reign of Bloody Mary has been a terrible reign for the English Puritans. The English queen entered into marriage with Philip II, the cruel king of Spain. What a mortal danger couched in this marriage for the Church of the Lord in England. Fervent Roman Catholic Spain, allied with England to exterminate the Reformation in England with root and branch. It could not coincide to greater disadvantage. God's Church was threatened with annihilation. Philip II, the merciless persecutor, who has also shed so much blood in Holland, and about whom we shall hear much more later, came personally to England to direct the Counter-Reformation. Also in England, not one heretic was permitted to remain. They had to be exterminated to the last person. Then their object would have been reached. Bloody Mary had a special hatred towards Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Had not Cranmer been the man who had advised Henry VIII to divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon? Had he not been the man who had contracted the marriage of Henry VIII with his maid of honor, Anne Boleyn? Oh, how she hated that man. Naturally, as soon as she came to the throne, she immediately had him arrested and locked up in prison. When both preachers, Latimer and Ridley, were burned in Oxford, Cranmer could just see both stakes from the barred window of his cell. Then that aged man bent his knees and implored God for strength. A short time later, the keys rattled and his cell door is thrown open. Cranmer expected nothing except that it was his turn to be burned. But, to his great astonishment, he was treated very kindly. He was transferred to another building and splendidly cared for. He was spared the rough treatment to which other prisoners were subjected. He really did not know what the reason was for this. And when, shortly after that, he was asked with friendly, persuasive words if he would acknowledge that he had been wrong and that the Pope was indeed the head of the English Church, then the old man succumbed to so much kindness, and he signed the piece of paper upon which his enemies had written that he revoked everything. He had not been aware that all that kindness was only hypocrisy, and that the purpose of the Roman Catholics was to have him walk into the trap. The Roman Catholics were jubilant about this victory. Just imagine, the generally respected and honored Cranmer had revoked everything. It could not be better. Splendid, splendid. What a victory for the Roman Catholic Church. As we already wrote, all that kindness wherewith the gray-haired man was treated was nothing else but vile deceit, because although Cranmer had recanted, he was still condemned to death. Bloody Mary did not think about releasing him. What do you think? He must die. She would take revenge. Her fury about all the sorrow which had been done to her mother and herself would only be cooled by the death of Cranmer. In March 1556, the cathedral at Oxford is entirely filled with people. Once more, before he shall die, Cranmer shall publicly revoke all. Although he had put his name down upon that piece of paper, now he would also declare it publicly, so that all could hear it. Behold, the gray-haired man ascends the pulpit laboriously. It becomes breathlessly quiet within the building. In the utmost suspense, all those that are present wait for that which Cranmer has to say. His friends cannot believe that Cranmer shall deny the truth. His enemies rejoice in advance at the thought of their complete victory. But instead of publicly recanting everything, he declares solemnly with a trembling voice that it grieves him that he had signed that paper. With emotional words, he relates his inward strife and assures all that he deeply regrets that which he had done. Now he no longer fears death which awaits him. Then his eyes begin to sparkle with enthusiasm, and his clear voice resounds through the church when he exclaims, "My hand has sinned by signing that paper. Well then, my hand shall be punished for that." While he put his right hand forward, he concludes with these words, "This hand shall be burned first." The impression which is caused by these words is terrific. The Roman Catholics gnash their teeth with rage. Their low, crafty plan has failed. Instead of a glorious victory, they have suffered a tremendous defeat. Their eyes sparkle with rage. Their faces are distorted by hatred. They drag the aged Cranmer roughly to the stake, which has been erected upon the same place where the previous year both preachers Latimer and Ridley were burned to death. There is not much left of their kindness. He is roughly tied fast to the pole which stands in the midst of the faggots. Soon the flames curl upward, and a soft mumbling rises from the crowded multitude. They crane their necks. They notice that Cranmer puts out his right hand and holds it up in the high curling flames. "Ah," they hear him say, "that unworthy right hand." He holds his hand in the flames until it is entirely burned black and charred. But then the roaring flames reach also his body. Immovable, the aged hero stands in the sea of fire. Once more he cries out something. The many spectators prick up their ears. "Listen, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." They are the last words of Thomas Cranmer. Soon the stakes cave in. The greedy flames die out. It is finished. Deeply impressed, the multitude returns homeward. His death has become a sermon to all that have beheld it, and to all that shall hear it. Bloody Mary has avenged herself. But 2 years later, already in 1558, she herself dies, while still very young. God summoned her before his formidable tribunal. She died without children. She ruled for only 5 years. Then God spoke, "Hitherto and no further." Elizabeth, a half-sister of Bloody Mary, ascended the English throne in 1558. She was a daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. She had to pass through difficult years when her half-sister ruled. To save her life, in public and before the people, she acted as if she was strict Roman Catholic, because her half-sister Mary knew no pity and spared no one. But all this was only pretense. However, she had scarcely assumed the reign, or she immediately restored the Anglican Church, that means the English State Church, which did not acknowledge the Pope as the head of the Church. Neither could she act differently because the Roman Catholics did not acknowledge her as Queen of England. For that reason, she had to take strong measures against the Roman Catholics because her crown was endangered. The religious persecutions which raged so violently during the reign of Bloody Mary were stopped immediately. The prison doors were opened, and all those who sighed in those musty cells because of their faith were liberated. Many refugees who had escaped from England during the bloody persecutions returned again, since the peril of death no longer threatened. The real Roman Catholics remained her fierce opponents until her death. They have laid so many plots to thrust her from the throne. Elizabeth remained unmarried her entire life. She brought England to great prosperity. The prosperity which during the persecution had declined was restored again. She was an intelligent, capable woman who knew what she wanted. She ruled her country with a firm hand. She often assisted and favored Holland. she permitted that the sea beggars regularly put into the English harbors to sell the captured ships and to buy provisions, powder, and bullets. Later, she has forbidden that because Philip II of Spain threatened her with war if she did not put an end to it. At that time, she yielded to that threat because she dared not let it come so far. Yet a few years later, after the murder of Prince William of Orange, she sent Leicester, an English general, with troops to the Netherlands to assist them in the severe struggle against Spain. It is true, not much has become of that assistance, and Leicester has done more harm than good, but these facts do not belong to the church history and are sufficiently known from Dutch history. Yet Elizabeth was not a God-fearing queen. Oh no, on the contrary, in many things she was not so particular. On the other hand, she was indifferent and crafty. It is true, she has restored the Anglican Church and would have nothing to do with the Pope of Rome, but she also considered the Puritans as her enemies. That English state church was far from pure. That church was not reformative, such as, for instance, the church at Geneva. The images in the churches, the crucifixes, the priestly garments of the Roman Catholics, and many other things were maintained. The Anglican church was duplex. That means that church was half Roman Catholic and half Protestant. For that reason, the real Protestants in England, the Puritans, would not join themselves to that church. They separated themselves from the Anglican Church and simply met in common homes and not in the church buildings. Queen Elizabeth was much displeased with that, and for that reason she persecuted the Puritans from time to time, although that persecution was far from being as fierce as under Bloody Mary. As we have already written, the real Roman Catholics were fierce opponents of Queen Elizabeth. In 1570, the Pope of Rome put Elizabeth under the ban. A Roman Catholic citizen had the courage to nail that papal excommunication to the gate of the palace in which the Anglican bishop lived. But he had to pay dearly for that. That action cost him his life, because he was seized and Queen Elizabeth had him hanged as a traitor. The Roman Catholics, and especially the Jesuits, have repeatedly attempted to murder Elizabeth. Attempt upon attempt has been perpetrated upon her. Her life was constantly threatened. At one time, the Jesuits tried to kill her with poison. Then again, they sent assassins to rob her of her life with a dagger. Happily, all those attempts failed. It usually came out, and the conspirators were severely punished. They usually had to pay for their deeds with their life. In 1561, the Queen of Scotland, Mary Stuart by name, had to flee out of her country. We hope to tell you more about that in the next chapter. Well then, this Mary Stuart, who was a zealous Roman Catholic, fled to Elizabeth. She was a cousin of the English Queen. But Elizabeth had her locked up in prison, because Mary Stuart herself wanted to become Queen of England. Later, Elizabeth even had her put to death. She could not act differently because her cousin, Mary Stuart, was a constant threat to her. The Jesuits conspired with the Scottish Queen to dethrone Elizabeth. At one time, England was in great danger. That came about like this. The Pope had given England as a present to Philip II, the King of Spain. But Philip himself had to conquer England. In that way, We can give also large presents, isn't that so? Yet this monarch was as happy as a child with that papal gift. Really quite silly, don't you think? To him, that was not bad at all, that he first had to conquer England himself. And what is more, didn't he have the papal blessing? Well then, that surely had to succeed. He already saw himself in the future crowned with the crown of England. He had an enormous fleet built, a fleet of more than 150 large warships. This was the well-known Armada, or Invincible Armada. This fleet was manned with 10,000 soldiers and sailors. Thousands of cannons would no doubt force open the gates of England. We all know how sad the end was of that Invincible Armada. Most of the ships were destroyed by an exceptionally fierce storm. They were dashed to pieces against the rocky coast of Scotland, and the greatest part of the sailors and soldiers found their graves in the waves or were beaten to death by the embittered people. Great joy prevailed in England. They celebrated everywhere, and bonfires were kindled. The church doors were also opened to thank God for the deliverance which he had granted them. But joy prevailed also in the Netherlands. It was not only aimed at England, oh no, but the Netherlands was also most closely involved in that. It was indeed the intention of Philip II first to conquer England, and from there to attack and to conquer the Netherlands. A commemorative medal was struck, encircled with the words, "God's breath has scattered them." With God's breath, that storm is intended. Thus it was, too, not the bravery of man, but the omnipotence of God, which he had manifested in the realm of nature, has destroyed that powerful fleet. God alone deserves all the honor for that. Yea, God was thanked for that victory in all Protestant countries in Europe, because if it had been successful, if England had really been conquered by Philip II, then the Reformation in Europe would have been destroyed. For that reason, we mention this event here, because God's church was directly involved in this. This great venture had to fail, because the Reformation was God's work, and that could not be destroyed. For that reason, the Lord sent that severe storm. For that reason, everything had to end in a complete failure. God cared for his own work. Behold also here again the golden thread of God's rule, which is also plainly visible in this history. Satan had to retreat and suffered a tremendous defeat. The sorrow in Spain was great, but Philip II forbade the wearing of mourning clothes. The mercies of the wicked are cruel. This venture was a direct attack upon God's church, for in addition to cannons and soldiers, there were also hundreds of Roman Catholic priests embarked upon the fleet who had large chests of medicines with them. Medicines? Were the English then sick? According to Rome, yes. Packed in those chests were thumb screws, tongs, and other instruments of torture by which the wandering sheep had to be lovingly brought back to the church again. That entire affair disappeared to the bottom of the sea, and very few of the Roman Catholic clergy returned to Spain. Queen Elizabeth died in 1603. Since she was unmarried, she had no children that could succeed her. After her death, both kingdoms, England and Scotland, were united into one kingdom. At that time, James I reigned in Scotland. He was a son of Mary Stuart, who had been killed by Elizabeth. And when, at the death of Elizabeth, who was unmarried, there was no successor to the throne, James I of Scotland became King of England at the same time. Queen Elizabeth has been of great importance to England. She has been an instrument in God's hand to preserve the Reformation in England from the threatening ruin. God has also built his church in England and Scotland. Many of God's people have lived there. We hope to come back to that in future chapters. Meanwhile, just keep this in mind.